Glad you're still here. That's good. So far, so good. And this morning, I am going to go back to where I left off in our study of Ashvaghosa's Awakening of Faith. You will all, of course, remember that we are still in part three. Interpretation, the longest chapter in the text. And it has several chapters in it. And for several weeks now, we forgot probably where we began, but for several weeks now, we've been talking about chapter one, which is called Revelation of True Meaning. So that's a lot to that one, right? By the way, as an aside, several of you have mentioned that you've been using the D.T. Suzuki translation of the text, and you have been pointing out to me that this version does not have all the divisions and chapters and subdivisions and so on that I've been talking about. And I have not looked into this very carefully, but I'm pretty sure that probably these divisions and chapters and subdivisions and so on are there in his version too. But they're just part of the text, you know, rather than pulled out and set aside as headings like they are in the Hakata translation. And I have both of these translations, and I've been referring back and forth, and I can always find, you know, the same passage in Suzuki that I find in Hakata. So they are the same text, although the English translations are different. Anyway. This doesn't matter at all, especially now that we're not reading or thinking about anything, so, but I mentioned it anyway. So in the last Dharma seminar, I finished a discussion of that first chapter in part three. So now we're on the second chapter. And this chapter is entitled, The Correction of Evil Attachments. And this is a shorter chapter. And this is not what it sounds like. This is just a little chapter. You know, you see these things now, like frequently asked questions. Well, this is like frequently committed misunderstandings. So he wants to correct the misunderstandings that inevitably have arisen from what he has said in the first chapter. And here he notes that we always have to say this because you forget it all the time, that that Buddhism is not a philosophy or a description of reality. As he said very early on, and we noticed this, the word suchness is the equivalent of the word shut up. Because the word suchness is meant to denote the limit of reality, the limit of what can be said, the limit of language, that is, the limit of what can be said. So nothing can be said about suchness, so shut up, because anything that you would say about it would of necessity be wrong. Which begs the question, why all these texts and all these complicated explanations? And the reason for it is that although probably we're not aware of it, we have already a lot of very complicated explanations in our minds about who we are and what reality is, and these explanations bind us to suffering because they create a false basis for our attachment. And these unconscious explanations need to be challenged and untangled. And that's why Ashvaghosa writes this text. So he's not proposing in the Awakening of Faith a set of alternate explanations that are more accurate than the ones we have. He's merely trying to undo the explanations that we have. Because there are no accurate explanations. So all the various misunderstandings that Ashwagosa mentions in this chapter have to do with mistaking the teaching for a teaching, not seeing that there actually is no teaching, that there's nothing that's being asserted as true. So the first misunderstanding that he mentions is to think that the Dharmakaya, true reality, the body of the Buddha, is quiescent like space. And the reason why we might think that is because he says that. He says exactly that. He says the Dharmakaya is quiescent like space. So I remember in our last Dharma seminar, Eva, maybe some of you were there, Eva brought up this exact point. She was complaining. She says, you know, I'm not so thrilled with the Dharmakaya being quiescent, like space, you know, unmoving, nothing stirring, not even a mouse. Remember I said that? She said, I'm not so sure about that. She said, what about life? What about movement, dance, color, art, you know? What about all that? Well, though he says very distinctly, quiescent like space, that is not what he means. He points out in this little chapter that actually he says quiescent like space, but what is space? There is no such thing as space. We have the idea of space and the concept of space because we have the idea of stuff in space. Since we have the idea of stuff, we have the idea of space, but there's no stuff, so there's no space. So when he says the Dharmakaya is quiescent like space, what he's really trying to say is that the Dharmakaya pervades everywhere. That's what he means. And as I said to Eva, it means that there is no aggression, there is no stickiness, there's no, you know, friction, even though the Dharmakaya includes everything that we see and experience as sticky and abrasive and troublesome and painful. So the next wrong view is that people see suchness or nirvana as empty, like the Heart Sutra says, all dharmas are empty. But of course, Ashwagosa says, no, it's not empty, because there is no empty. No such thing as empty or any idea that matches the word empty. Emptiness is just a word that we employ as a skillful means, again, to try to get us over our stickiness. And he says that if you say that the Dharmakaya is empty, you miss the fact that the Dharmakaya is endowed with all kinds of wonderful and excellent qualities. But of course, as soon as you say that, people are naturally going to think that the Dharmakaya is full of all kinds of excellent qualities, which is not at all the case, because the Dharmakaya is not a thing alongside of other things that have various kinds of qualities. Anyway, I think you get the pattern here. You get the basic idea. And the thing about it is that you will observe this in your own mind. No doubt you have been observing this already as you practice during Sesshin. Probably this has happened to you in the last day or so, when suddenly you seem to understand something or feel something, and immediately you want to make it into something. Do you notice this? It seems nearly impossible not to turn our insight and experience into an idea of some sort, an object of some sort. But there are no objects, and there is no mind to perceive objects. And soon enough, when your mind becomes very, very quiet, and therefore loosens its gripping habit, you'll see this, and you'll be willing to be easy about it and just let go of all of your brilliant insights and experiences and just go to the next moment. Just let everything melt away and go to the next moment, because there's nothing that's not melting away. We are constantly needing somehow to make something out of nothing. But there is no something and there is no nothing. So we have to learn how to let the mind move when it moves without needing to do something with it. The next thing Ashvaghosa brings up in this chapter is the special kind of misunderstanding that is promulgated by the Hinayanists. By Hinayanists, he means the followers of the early pre-Mahayana teachings. Now, these days, it is really out of style to think of Hinayanists. The word is almost never used. Or even to think that there is a right and a wrong in Buddhist doctrine and practice. We don't think like that, you know, anymore. We think, well, there's different kinds of practice and different kinds of understanding because there's different kinds of people with different kinds of needs, which all seems pretty true. But for sure, in some Mahayana texts, including this one, there is a bit of attitude. And so to even use the word Hinayanist is already, you know, an attitude, because it's a pejorative term. Hinayana literally means lesser vehicle, as opposed to the greater vehicle, the Mahayana. So what is the mistake that the Hinayanists make? The mistake that the Hinayanists make is that they think that there's something that's real. That's their big mistake. They're smart enough to know that self is unreal and the world as we construct it with our minds is unreal. They know that. But they persist in the idea that the constituents of the self and the world are real. And that is why they are so desperate to get out of samsara, which is really terrible, and to get into nirvana, which is a great relief. But this is actually wrong, and that is why they continue to suffer despite the illusion that they've left samsara behind. In reality, there is no samsara or nirvana, and all constituents of reality are unborn and imperishable. And here's the last paragraph of that discussion, of the whole discussion about misunderstandings. Here's how he sums it up. Thus, all things from the beginning are neither matter nor mind, neither wisdom nor consciousness, neither being nor non-being. They are ultimately inexplicable, and yet they are still spoken of. It should be understood that the Tathagatas, applying their expedient means, make use of conventional speech in a provisional manner in order to guide people so that they can be free from their deluded thoughts and can return to suchness. For if anyone thinks of anything as real and absolute in its own right, that person causes their mind to be trapped in samsara, and consequently, they cannot enter the state filled with true insight, the state of awakening. And that's the end of that short chapter, that statement. So I was writing that down, you know, and thinking to myself, oh my God, this must be so repetitive to everybody. How can you listen to another word of this? It's so repetitive. And it's so frustrating, right, to hear stuff like this. I mean, what do you do with stuff like that? And here we are, you know, with our aches and our pains and our, you know, we have real human problems, right? And here come these ancient Buddhists from 1,000 years ago, on and on and on with their subtle discussions about what is real and what is not real. and what we can talk about and what we can't talk about. And sometimes you think they had nothing better to do than be writing about all this. They didn't have any dishes to wash. They didn't have to sweep the floor. They didn't have a job, you know. Maybe they didn't have a job. Maybe this was their job. I don't know. But anyway, does any of this matter, this stuff, really and truly? And okay, maybe 1,000 years ago, it did matter. It mattered to them. Let's give them that. But can't we safely leave them there 1,000 years ago? Do we have to like bring them up again now? As if it was as relevant to us as it is to them? These are good questions. And I mean, I guess, the debates about what is real and what is not real are on the whole amusing and interesting if you have a taste for them. And pretty silly if you don't. But here's the problem. Fortunately, or unfortunately, probably unfortunately, we have to die. That's the problem. And death just doesn't compute. It doesn't, it really doesn't fit in anywhere into the this world framework in which we're living every day and in which we have our problems. It doesn't fit in. It is literally out of this world, death, right? It doesn't fit. So then you say, well, why can't we just be grown-ups about it? Why don't we just be grown-ups and just simply say, all right, maybe we don't get it, but that's the way it is. We all have to die. And it, you know, it's not that bad, really. In fact, practically speaking, it's a necessity. So let's just forget about it and go on with life, right? Why not? This is not a bad idea. Actually, it's actually a pretty good approach. And long ago, the Greeks had exactly that idea. And I've been thinking about it because lately I've been reading a book about a famous poem called De Rerum Natura. De Rerum Natura is one of the greatest poems ever written. The translation of that phrase, the Latin phrase, is On the Nature of Things. It's a big, multi-volume poem written in hexameters by Lucretius. And that's what it says. It is not only an elegant poem, but it is a very organized philosophical treatise that explains pretty much everything, starting with atoms. And it's an exposition of Epicurean philosophy. Lucretius was an Epicurean. Epicurean philosophy is a lot more than eat, drink, have sex, and be merry, which is what the Christians defined it to be, because they didn't like Epicureanism that much, and they sort of ridiculed it and made it into a kind of cartoon. But it's actually much more than that, and much more sophisticated than that. And when you think about what it is pretty much the idea that governs the entire modern contemporary secular world. It's pretty much the idea that we all have. Life is good. Don't make a problem. Enjoy it. Don't worry about God. Don't worry about heaven. Don't worry about damnation. Don't worry about what's real and not real. Yes, we die. He writes about death, you know. He says, yes, we die, and that's fine. You can't help it. But what's the point of stressing out over it? It happens later on. It's not that bad a thing. So just be a moral, moderate, well-adjusted intelligent citizen, and everything will work out. Pretty much. What's not to agree with, right? Don't we all agree with that? So what's wrong with us? We can't just, you know, live like that. But somehow, for some weird people like you, probably there are others equally weird. Probably a lot of human beings are like this. Possibly most human beings are like this. Maybe all human beings are like this. There are fears, there are desires, there is longing, and we find ourselves, whether it makes sense or not, haunted by our human life and its great perplexities. And we know a lot. I mean, every day, the amount of stuff that we know today that we didn't know yesterday is staggering. And yet the more we know, the more we notice how little we know and how we've been wrong about almost everything. And the anguish of loss and death, and just the feeling of not getting it right in this lifetime persists. Stupid as it might be to think that way, we feel it. So, for so many of us, there is a need to engage with life's deepest questions, a need to somehow, in some way, find some understanding, find some peace. There's really seems to be no reason why we can't all be Epicureans and just enjoy life. Relax, live. What's the problem? But we just can't seem to manage it. So along comes the Buddha. He says, yes, it's true, you know, this is a big problem, your life. It's built in, you can't avoid it. And notice that the effort to safely set it aside and go on to other things really doesn't work. So you need to confront these problems. And if you confront them wisely, you can overcome them. That's what the Buddha says. So the Buddha devises a way of practice to overcome our suffering, a way of practice compelling enough to be handed down for many thousands of years, and a way of life, a way to understand life, so as to undo our various misconceptions. And then after a while, along comes Ashvaghosa, along with lots of others who say, but look, if you define the path and the doctrine so that you can understand them and grasp them, you will inevitably attach to them. And this will become just another way for you to continue your suffering. Just look at your own mind. See how you insist over and over and over again on imprisoning yourself with your own mind. Go deeper. Turn your mind around. See how there's no separate you that is born and dies and is so and is therefore lonely. See how every moment of your life has always been a moment of belonging, a moment of loving, a moment of coming together and falling apart. Catastrophes do happen. Losses do happen. Sorrow happens at loss because we love. But when you completely become yourself and embrace your life as it really is, there is no suffering. What we call suffering is no longer there. And it's that that Ashmagosa wants us to understand. And he's going about it in the only way, in the best way, in the most thorough way that he knows how. We are truly amazing creatures, we human beings, unfathomable, creatures. And look at all the great stuff we have done. Civilization is great, don't you think? Civilization. I mean, cities with giant buildings. And all those restaurants with those good, all that good food, all the books, the music, the art, and the great religions of the world. And at the same time, as we're now, to our great sorrow, contemplating civilization is also really terrible. Think of the harm it has caused. Not only to the earth and other creatures, but to human beings. There's always going to be death, but human civilization has made so much more death than we otherwise would have had. And it's a terrible thought that it's possible. And all the great things of civilization and all the terrible things must go together. That you can't have a flush toilet without a murder. That's a terrible thought. But who knows? Maybe it's true. And religions are like that too. I myself personally find that there's hardly anything more beautiful than Christianity as a tradition. Think of the founding story of Christianity. What could be more beautiful than that? Love and sacrifice. And the mystics and the saints throughout history have led beautiful and inspiring lives and left us wonderful, wonderful teachings. And that's why it's, to me, so lovely to be here, to see evidence of this all over the place, feel its spirit. And it's the most natural thing in the world for people to think, wow, this is so beautiful. This is so wonderful. We should share this with everybody because they need it. It's going to help them so much. They're going to be just as happy as we are. And so naturally, you're going to try to do that. And when powerful people decide they want to help you do it, of course you're going to get involved with them for that reason. And before you know it, you have this big, powerful religion. The emperor converts to it, You have this big, powerful religion. And you have lots of powerful and ambitious people who then want to join that big, powerful religion and exercise their ambition in it. And it's a good thing because we're going to spread it all over. But then you have armies and political alliances. You have three popes vying with each other in Florence, in Italy, in France. And you have schisms and you have the Protestants pretty soon. And then you have all kinds of bad stuff. And so the very goodness of religion becomes the cause of enormous suffering and corruption, which is really terrible, but it happens. Would it be nice to say it's those Christians? But no, it happens exactly the same in Greece, exactly in Asia, where in the same way it becomes powerful and connected, and pretty soon it becomes identical to the national ethos. I remember when we went to Korea, we were so impressed with how beautiful and well kept up the monasteries were. And that's because the government supports them lavishly because they're national treasures. There's no separation of church and state, you know. These monasteries are the soul, heart and soul of the Korean ethic, identity. And of course, your religion will always serve those who support it. But never mind all that. I'm sorry I brought it up. Because we're not here for all that. It's nothing to do with us, right? All we're trying to do is take care of ourselves a little bit and be happy and be the best human beings that we can be. And we're just practicing Soto Zen in the Suzuki Roshi lineage, which at the moment is not an all-powerful religion, but just a bunch of us people, you know, doing this. And yes, we have our own tradition and our own particular history and flavor. The present Soto Zen tradition is based on a close reading and a constant reading of the teachings of Dogen. And mostly we study Dogen more than anything else. And everything we understand otherwise, we understand through Dogen's eyes. And since Dogen taught and sincerely meant it that there is no Soto Zen, there is no Zen at all, there's just Buddha Dharma, we take that to heart. And so we study all kinds of Dharma from early to late. And we really don't think we're doing Zen. We think we're doing just Buddha Dharma. And Suzuki Roshi was an ordinary Japanese Zen priest from a smallish temple. He wasn't a great Zen master, but for some reason, he had the feeling that he wanted to get away from the narrow confines of Japanese Soto Zen, and he wanted to go to America. So he came. And because he didn't speak English very well, and because he had no idea who these crazy young people were who were showing up, he sort of fumbled around to try to way to find a way in English to express himself. And somehow or other, he developed this very compelling and beautiful and simple way of explaining the tradition. Whereas Zen in America seemed at first to be about the heroic effort to push through to enlightenment, Suzuki Roshi taught, no, that enlightenment is just how you live every moment. For a long time, I remember in the early years of practice in America, they used to complain about Soto Zen and specifically about San Francisco Zen Center. They used to complain that it was very uptight. They were so concerned about their little forms and their incense and their bowing and all that. That's all they could see. And they were not very enlightened at all. And I know this because I studied with a few Zen teachers, and when I came to them, they automatically tried to straighten me out from these problems. They weren't wrong. So everything good has its bad side, of course. So I used to have the joke that in our lineage, we weren't very enlightened, but we had the best food. Unfortunately, the food is not so good anymore. But it was very good a while ago. Getting enlightened and getting good at enlightenment is almost an art form. We are not that artistic. Let's be honest, we're just trying to get through the day. To be a little kind if we can be, to be compassionate, and not too crazy. So I will share with you a passage from Becoming Yourself. This is Suzuki Roshi on the subject of great effort. When you practice Zen, you will, of course, have pain in your legs, and you will have some difficulty mentally. You will find that it is rather difficult to be concentrated only on your breathing. One after another, various images will come into your mind, or your mind will go out for a walk, wandering about. It is rather difficult for me too. You should understand that the difficulties you have in Zazen do not take place outside of your mind. So to deal with them, you have to accept the difficulty that you have, and you should keep up your effort. But you should not try to make some effort based on your small mind. When you say, "My practice should be better," that is small mind. To say, "My practice," is not right. Buddha's practice should be better, but not yours. If your small self acts without the care of big mind, that is not Zen. You should be well taken care of by big mind, and your practice should be based on big mind. When it is, even though the pain in your legs will be the same, the way that you handle it will be quite different. We say Zen practice and precepts are one. To observe precepts is to practice Zen. They are the same thing. The precepts are not exactly a moral code, but they do include many rules. Most of these rules are almost impossible to observe completely. I don't think you can observe them, but if you practice Zazen, you can observe them. The secret of observing precepts is to see that the dualistic idea of to observe or not to observe takes place only within your own mind. Practicing Zen, you see that you have no one to blame, and there is no one who is violating precepts. When you make the effort to observe precepts, even if the effort is not complete, it is the effort of Buddha mind. If you think that you yourself are outside of the precepts or Buddha mind, it won't be possible to observe them completely. On the other hand, if your activity is an expression of Buddha's big activity, then whatever you do is Buddha's effort, and even though it is not perfect, you are manifesting Buddha's compassionate activity. According to his record, Dogen was enlightened when he heard his master slap a disciple sitting next to him. You all know the story, right? It's the middle of the night, and they're all staying up all night sitting, and his teacher takes off his slipper and whacks the person sitting next to Dogen and says to him, "What are you doing? You have to make a great effort," because the guy was falling asleep. It's the middle of the night, you know, it's very understandable. You can tell someone's sleeping because they're sitting like this, right? He whacks them. "You have to make an effort." And the part of the story that everyone remembers is Dogen then says, "Body and mind dropped away." But Suzuki Roshi doesn't even mention that part. He just says, he slapped him and said, "Make a big effort." That great effort we have to make is Zen and the observance of precepts. If we make our best effort with confidence on each moment, that's enlightenment. Don't ask whether your observation is perfect or not. When you do your best to observe precepts and to practice Zen, right there is enlightenment. There's no other way to attain enlightenment. Enlightenment is not some particular stage. It's everywhere. Wherever you are, enlightenment is there. When you do whatever you do with your best effort, that's enlightenment. The point is very important. This point is very important for our Zen practice and for our everyday life. Because our Zen practice is part of our everyday life. And we should make our best effort in our everyday life. It's not Zen at all if we just come and sit here for 40 minutes or a week without also making our effort in everyday life. I don't know how that all sounds to you, but whenever I hear Suzuki Roshi's talking, I always feel good. It makes me happy, you know. I always feel somehow the depth of what he's saying. Maybe there's a little mystery in what he's saying. But at the same time, you know, it is so simple and so friendly, don't you think? It's really friendly. You don't feel like he's trying to like astound you or make you feel like some awesome thing. You feel like he's just sort of semi-mumbling in a quiet voice. And making you feel at home. And when he says big mind or Buddha mind, you know, naturally you conjure up some big, big, endless space, like some giant balloon or cocoon surrounding everything. But there's no balloon and there's no cocoon and there's no big mind to picture or understand. And that's exactly what Ashwagosa is trying to tell us in this chapter that I'm talking about. Don't make a big mind in your small mind, because it's just small mind. And big mind is small mind. The small mind is big mind. Not being caught by small mind. Not grasping small mind is big mind. There's no other big mind. There's no other Buddha mind. This is why enlightenment is not an art form or an expertise, an achievement. It really is what life is all the time. And even when religion becomes a big problem or a small problem, we have a small religion, so we have small problems. Still, big mind is big mind. Still, reality is always reliable, and we have no choice but to rely on it. And we have to be able to live peacefully in all kinds of weather, all kinds of conditions, all the time. And what's nice about Sesshin is that somehow or other, we do get in touch with this big mind. Somehow or other, we feel it in our body. We feel it in our breath. We were touched by it somehow. And we make friends with it. And we can't possibly keep our mind peaceful and content all the time. Maybe in Sesshin we can have some time like that, and it's just such a pleasure. So Sesshin goes away quickly, goes by quickly, and then it's over, and we go on. But we can really appreciate this week when our body and mind softens enough to begin to glimpse the feeling of big mind, which will go away like everything, but its influence on our lives will last forever. But we are living this week together. Will go away, and it will last forever. So thank you so much for your practice. I really appreciate your being here and listening to my notes. And